everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'm so thrilled to be here with all of you today. I have a great show planned for you. Samantha Levy from the American Farmland Trust will be joining us. She's the climate policy manager there. And I'm really thrilled to have her on and tell us what's going on across the country and especially here in New York as far as climate policy goes. But first, I want to share with you some things going on in and around the news, some ways you can take action, and of course, share my weekly recipe with you. First, I am gearing up for the holidays. It's been, you know, last year and this year have been really a little weird for me because for the past 25 years prior to this, I have been cooking for the homeless through the organization, the River Fund New York, which is a wonderful nonprofit food pantry that really takes the whole family into under their wings, basically, and does whatever they can to support them, primarily with food, but helps them sign up for any social services that they need, etc. And they're really a great organization. And every year for the past 25 years, Thanksgiving, I've been cooking a whole Thanksgiving feast with the help of my community volunteers. And we do the same for Christmas. And then, of course, we also collect coats. And during Christmas time, a few years ago, we actually started collecting hand, which is a nice initiative. And I know have this jewelry that and we started collecting it and putting it into beautiful gift boxes and handing that out to the young people at the food pantry who are looking for holiday gifts for people in their family. So it was really great because we, you know, everybody does toy collections this time of year, but there's really a gap for the, you know, adolescent girls who want some jewelry. And so our collection really helped. But anyway, this year we're not doing it because of COVID. All of the organizations I know that were doing cooking have really cut that out. And so so what I have been doing is, you know, for Thanksgiving, I really acted as a transport service and people were calling me saying they had turkeys, you know, did I know who needed them and I would deliver them. I created a couple boxes for some families that I knew needed stuff, you know, from the turkey down to the stuffing, to the pumpkin pie, et cetera. And we created full boxes and dropped those off at people's homes. I guess the Mid-Island JCC, they had 40 kosher turkeys that they needed a home for. And I was able to transfer that to Long Island Cares. Island Harvest, sorry, to Island Harvest. You know, they're all wonderful organizations. And thank God we have these wonderful organizations doing such important work, feeding those that are in need. And just knowing from all these years where to take things really makes me a resource for my community. And so I'm putting it out there. If anybody has coats, donate and know where to donate it to, feel free to reach out to me at Bhavani Help Right Place. We still did a huge coat collection and people from Brooklyn came out and picked those up from the East Flatbush Community Partnership. They came out and picked up all the coats and they would love to do it again for Christmas. So if when items that they'd like to donate, please, you can drop them off at the IE Green Homestead. If you have food that you want to donate, where it needs to go. Some ways that you can take action, you know, in my newsletter this week, I wrote about pushing the EPA to create stronger regulations to rein in the methane in our atmosphere. Methane is the second largest contributor to the climate crisis after carbon dioxide, and it traps more than 86 times more heat than carbon dioxide. And so if we really want to address global warming, we really need to address the methane that we release into the atmosphere. And organizations have said to me this week about this issue. One was from the Center of Food Safety, and they were really focusing on factory farms and the methane that comes out of factory farms. The other organization with Earth was Earth Justice, and they were focusing on the oil and gas industries. Both of these industries really impact the environment a lot with their methane gas pollution. Each year, the oil and gas industry releases about 16 million metric tons of methane into the atmosphere. And I was so surprised to really read that factory farms account for 13% of methane emissions in the country. So this is all, you know, really, really important to focus on if we really want to rein in the pollution in our atmosphere and get the climate crisis under control. So there's two websites. Links are in my website. Under, if you go to the blog and then go under Take Action, there are links for the Center of Food Safety and Earth Justice's petition. And I ask you to please sign both of them. If you don't get my newsletter, you can also sign up for my newsletter on my website. You know, it goes out every week, and I will let you know who my guests will be on my radio show, as well as let you know what important things you can do to take action. The other thing I wrote about this week was President Biden and his, you know, offshore drilling plans. I am just flawed and beyond upset at President Biden. You know, he's done more than any U.S. presidency to really try to address climate change on one hand. And then on the other hand, he's making deals with the oil and gas industry to lease huge swaths of water for offshore drilling. And it doesn't make sense. I mean, here he's, you know, putting forth the Build Back Better agenda, which really addresses so much of the climate agenda that we need to focus on. And he, you know, makes the commitment to reduce our global impact, you know, by 2030. And yet he's making these deals with the oil and gas. He's considering a proposal to sell over 1 million acres of Alaska's coastland for offshore drilling. And last month, he leased over 80 acres in the Gulf of Mexico to the fossil fuel industry. And we just know that that's complete insanity. We've seen what happened in the Gulf with the leak and the explosion, and we've seen what has happened up in Alaska before. I mean, these oil and gas industries, these drilling, fossil fuel, they leak. They have explosions. They are unsafe, and they are bad all the way around. And we need to push towards renewable energy sources. And making these deals behind the back room just does not make sense. So please sign those petitions as well. And then lastly, what I shared was that the ban for styrofoam goes into effect January 1st, which is just really great. I cannot tell you how long. I mean, I think I was back in school, I was boycotting styrofoam. And believe me, when I was in high school many years ago. So styrofoam has been, you know, polluting our earth for so many years. There's no way that it doesn't break down. It ends up in the landfills, and it's cheap and lightweight. And so fast food industries have been using it nonstop for so long. Even the packaging companies, even, you know, Amazon puts it in those little pellets for packaging. All of that will come to an end on January 1st, at least in New York State. Hopefully other states will follow. So anyway, that's really, really great news. So I'm really thrilled with that. So the recipe this week, during Thanksgiving, I made this vegan gluten-free cornbread. And I'm not gluten-free, but I have some family members that are and guests that were. So, you know, if you're not gluten-free and you want to substitute regular flour, you can. But this recipe was vegan and gluten-free, and it was just so delicious. So here you go. For the ingredients, you want 3/4 cup of yellow cornmeal, 1/2 cup of masa harina corn flour. And that's basically corn that is ground down with a little bit of lime in it. And it's just really delicious, and it's used a lot in Mexican food for making tortillas and stuff. But anyway, you can buy masa harina in most stores. Certainly Whole Foods has it, but a lot of supermarkets have it as well. 1 cup of gluten-free flour, whatever gluten-free flour you like to use. two teaspoons of baking powder, 1 teaspoon of baking soda, 1/2 teaspoon of salt, 1 tablespoon of egg replacer with 2 tablespoons of water. I also did 1 tablespoon of ground flaxseed mixed with 1 tablespoon apple cider vinegar and 2 tablespoons water. That's kind of like my mock egg, what I usually do. And so if you don't have egg replacer, you can just do 2 tablespoons of the ground flaxseed. Yes, just double that up instead of the egg replacer. But for some reason, I bought the egg replacer, and so I had it here, so I used it. 1 cup of almond milk or oat milk or coconut milk, whichever you have in your house. 1/4 cup of sunflower oil or another oil that you have in your house. 1/4 cup of coconut oil. 1/2 cup of maple syrup. And 1 1/2 cups of organic frozen corn kernels. You're going to start by preheating the oven to 375 and spray a 9 by 9 inch square dish with oil. Now, I actually didn't have a 9 by 9. I think I used like an 8 by 13. Basically, any rectangle will do, but about a 9 by 9 inch square of space is what this recipe calls for. And I also doubled it and it worked fine. So if you have a larger pan, you want to double it, you can do that as well. In a small bowl, you're going to combine the flax seed with the apple cider vinegar and the water and let that sit for about 5 minutes. And you're going to do the same with the egg replacer and let that sit. And you can combine them and do them in one bowl. That will work as fine as well. Add the dry ingredients to one bowl. Add the coconut milk and the almond milk to another bowl. Melt the coconut oil. You know, in the summer, my coconut oil is soft enough, but in the winter, because it sits by a windowsill, it gets hard. So I melted it first. And then I mix it with the almond milk in another bowl. And then added the coconut oil, the almond milk all together, and then added the flaxseed egg to that bowl. Mixed it all up with the whisk. You want to do that and make sure you remove any lumps before you add the wet ingredients into the dry ingredients. Once you've gotten all the lumps out, go ahead and add those wet ingredients to the dry ingredients. And using the same whisk, you're going to mix that together, but you don't want to overmix it. You just really want to make sure that all the dry is incorporated into the wet, but you're not looking to beat it up because that can make it tough. So just mixing it up till everything's wet. Run the frozen corn underwater just to defrost it. You don't have to cook it or anything, but you want to get any ice off of the frozen corn. Drain it well, and then add that to the corn batter. Just fold the frozen corn in and then pour the batter into your prepared baking dish. You're going to bake it for 30 to 40 minutes or until a knife inserted into the center comes out clean. And that is it. Really, really delicious. I hope you all make it. Of course, I love feedback. So if you do, share it on Facebook, send me a message, let me know how you liked it. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you my guest, Samantha Levy. Samantha is the climate policy manager at Farmland Trust. And she coordinates the organization's federal and state policy agenda and strategy to help farmers reduce greenhouse gas emissions. She also works to sequester more carbon into the soil, host well-sited renewable energy facilities, and permanently protect more farmland. Prior to this role, Samantha coordinated American Farmland Trust public policy agenda in New York State to save land that sustains us, leading the Alliance for New York's Farmland to advocate for farmland protection and access policies, and convening and leading the New York Grown Food for New York Kids, which successfully secured passage of an incentive to help K-12 schools buy more food from local farms. I'm sure we'll be talking more about that as my prior job of being the farm to school coordinator, getting that food from farms into the local schools was really a challenge and something I know she worked on really well together. Samantha also led American Farmland Trust's climate work in New York and was an appointed member of the Climate Action Council's Agricultural and Forestry Advisory Panel, and that helped New York achieve its greenhouse gas emissions reduction goals for these sectors, as well as the governor's Racial Equity and Diversity in Agricultural Work Group. Before joining the American Farmland Trust in 2017, Amantha interned for the U.S. Senator Kristen Gillibrand and Slow Food USA, and worked as a farmer's market manager in the New York metro region. Samantha was named one of City and State's 40 Under 40 Rising Stars in Albany in 2020, and was listed on the New York Agriculture Power 50 list in 2021. She holds a Bachelor's in Fine Arts from New York University's Tisch School of the Arts, a Master's in Food Systems from NYU, and is a year one graduate from Cornell University's LEAD New York program. Samantha, welcome.
Thank you. You're making me blush.
Don't be silly. You deserve all that. You're really amazing. Amazing.
Thank you.
So, so you recently moved on from working solely with New York State to, you know, to really work more broadly with the climate action across the country. Can you talk a little bit about that, that new role that you have?
I sure can. But first, let me just say thank you for having me on your show, Bhavani. It's a pleasure to be here with you. And thank you for all your engagement over the years in our farm to school work. It was really lovely to work alongside you and so many others in that coalition to get some good policies passed. Strengthen that local food system.
Well, you know,
help kids eat more local food.
When I got your bio, I was so amazed at how much we have in common in our path. You know, I also went to art school and found my path through food. So, you know, I really loved seeing that too. You know, food really just became
my art.
Yeah, I
find that pretty. Yeah, it's pretty common. I think in this field. Maybe not so much in agricultural policy, but perhaps more so as we move forward. But I know a lot of farmers who came from the art world. There are definite synergies in creation there.
Yeah, absolutely. So
yeah. So you asked about
your current Biden. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, you asked about the transition from New York to national. For those who don't know us, American Farmland Trust is a national organization with regional and state level field offices across the nation. And our mission is to save the land that sustains us. In a few words, keep land and farming, keep farmers on the land, help them adopt sound farming practices that improve soil health and resilience to climate impacts and also mitigate climate change. So we have several different approaches on the climate side. You read off a few of them in my bio. We want to reduce emissions, create a just transition for farmers so that they're able to stay in business and support their families, but also reduce emissions in ways that we really need now, to increase carbon sequestration, improve soil health, improve resiliency to extreme weather and drought, especially if you're looking at the western part of our country. It's horrible what's happening. It's really, really tough, very much squeezing people, the lack of water resources. And then we also look at farmland protection as a climate strategy. And of course, a renewable energy siting is a really relevant conversation for an organization that works on farmland protection. I mean, we could talk a little bit more about that if that interests you. But looking at the differences between New York and national, the politics are certainly different. In New York, we've got a Democratic governor, democratically led Senate and Assembly. And those toeholds, or not toeholds, the power that's resting with the Democratic Party is pretty firm. There are super majorities in both the Senate and the Assembly. Nationally, it's very different. You know, we're a big country with a lot of different points of view. And it takes a lot of coalition building to bring people together when you're looking across the country. And agriculture in New York is different from agriculture across the country as well. So lots of differences between the two. It's an interesting new challenge.
Mm-hmm. In the current Biden reconciliation package, it's, you know, trying to address farming and the climate crisis. Can you talk a little bit about how he's doing that?
Yeah, I so appreciate that question, because you mentioned calls to action before, and this is one of the most relevant calls to action that we have right now. So for folks, particularly folks who have Democratic U.S. senators that represent them, now is a really key moment to be reaching out to those folks and talking to them about what you like about the reconciliation package. Because those conversations are ongoing. We started at $3.5 trillion overall over the course of 10 years, and that's been cut down now to, I think it's 1.9 or something resembling that. And within that package, currently there's $28 billion. That's billion with a B. These are very different scales of funding than we saw, than we see at the state level generally. $28 billion that would go towards helping farmers adopt conservation practices through existing conservation programs. This would be an historic investment. I can't stress this enough that, you know, these are programs are oversubscribed. They're one of the main ways that we help farmers adopt practices that improve soil health and sequester carbon. And this would be a game-changing investment. I mean, this is some of the best opportunity that we will probably have, even leading up to the next farm bill, to increase investment into these critical programs that increase carbon sequestration, improve soil health, reduce emissions, help farmers farm in ways that preserve water quality and other environmental goals. So we want to make sure that this funding stays in and that this act passes. You know, otherwise, we're going to see a much tougher razor's edge fight as we go into Farm Bill in terms of funding for these critical programs.
Yeah. And, you know, the Farm Bill always comes up because it's also, you know, the bill that supports social services like SNAP program and everything. And people don't realize that that's also a part of the Farm Bill. And it's just such an important package, you know, and why they have it all together. I don't know, but they do. So
I can answer that. I could take a stab at answering that question.
Sure, sure.
I mean,
I'm
think
sure
about the politics.
I want to know.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about the politics, if you have a farm bill that's just focused on farm needs, you're going to lose votes from the folks who are representing urban districts and peri-urban districts. So it's important to knit it all together, I think, was the thinking behind it when it became an omnibus package, because you need 60 votes to pass a farm bill in the Senate. And a majority in the House. So you really have to make sure that you're building strong coalitions. I think that it was really a political exercise to have them both put together.
Can you talk about the Biden administration's 30 by 30 climate initiative? What is that?
Yeah, sure. So this was an international initiative, science-driven. It's been discussed for decades now. It's really the main goal of 30 by 30 is to preserve biodiversity. This is obviously very relevant in our food system, when we're looking at our soils, when we're looking at seed availability, and also when we're looking at wildlife habitat on farms. So, you know, really making sure that we are increasing biodiversity is absolutely critical to resilience in the face of climate change, so that we can be resilient in the face of climate change and have a resilient society. So 30 by 30 is an initiative. It's been an international initiative to protect 30% of lands and waters by 2030. When President Joe Biden took over, he announced that he wanted a 30 by 30 initiative for the United States, and he put out an executive order. There's been a bill introduced in New York State by Senator Kaminsky on Long Island and Assemblywoman Pat Fahey up in the Capital Region to make a 30 by 30 goal for New York State. That one didn't pass last year, but there are many folks who have been working on that. It's an important biodiversity initiative, but, you know, of course, you can't really decouple the two. Biodiversity and climate go hand in hand. So yeah, that's the basic premise there. And there's it's in its early stages, I would say, in the U.S. of folks deciding and determining what counts. And AFT really wants to make sure that we're seeing, you know, permanent open space protection, also permanent farmland protection, so protecting farmland from development, and then also conservation. These long-term adoption of practices that improve soil health and provide wildlife habitat on farms, these can all really contribute to increasing biodiversity as well. And we've got lots of farmland across the United States where farmers can play a role there.
Mm-hmm. You know, I mentioned it in my opening talk about the conflict and the discrepancy in Biden's approach to the climate when he puts forward the Build Back Better plan on one hand, and then on the other goes ahead and leases, you know, millions of acres of open water to fossil fuel companies. Can you talk a little bit about that? How can he be a part of the 30 by 30 climate initiative and at the same time be leasing out water to these, you know, fossil fuel companies?
Yeah, I hear you. I hear your frustration. I can't really comment directly on it, but I can say that the administration's also shown a deep commitment to growing renewable energy. And I think that that's something that we're going to see more of in the future. We're going to see more of it in New York State in the future. So as we're transitioning away from fossil fuels, you know, I think that as we look forward, we need to be making sure that we're making investments in growing renewable energy and citing those projects in ways that also help us preserve our important biodiversity and conservation goals.
Mm-hmm. Do you foresee any of the farms that and the open farmland that we're protecting transitioning towards wind farms and, you know, working? You know, I know so many farmers end up selling out their land because they can make more money, you know, selling their land to development. So keeping it in farmland, I've heard, you know, some are looking towards, you know, setting up wind farms on their land. Can you talk about that?
Right. So, yeah. And Bhavani, remind me, you're located on Long Island, right?
Correct. Yeah.
Great. Yeah. So I just want to get my bearings here. Lots to say about that. Gosh, you've touched on an enormous topic. Well, first, I'll just say that for farmland that we're protecting with conservation easements and purchasing development rights, we're not, you know, developing that land for wind or solar. That's staying forever farmland. And, you know, I think that there are some nuances there in terms of what we can and should allow, like, and we can get a little bit more into that later. But yeah, and if we back up just a moment, one key area for AFT, particularly in our New York office, but certainly nationwide, is this trending of our farmers towards just getting older. It's really challenging for new and beginning farmers and farmers of color and marginalized farmers, folks who have not really been represented in the industry or allowed to gain a toehold in the industry, really. It's been really challenging for new farmers to establish themselves. And so we have this, you know, I think it's 40% of our farmers nationwide are over 65. And, yeah, you know, the fate of those acres, those millions and millions of acres, is up in the air if they don't have a next generation. And I can speak to New York directly. A third of our farmers are over 65, and they own or operate nearly 2 million acres of farmland that is going to be changing hands, that is changing hands. You know, it's a really complicated prospect financially, emotionally, and otherwise. And 92% of those senior farmers don't have a young person working alongside them poised to take over. I mean, I'm going to say that again. A third of our farmers are over 65, and 92% of them don't have someone to take over. So it's really critical that we solve this and make sure that there are options available to these farmers and farm families beyond just selling for development. Now, solar can support, and, you know, I talk about solar because I'm no expert in wind, but what I hear is that land-based wind is, you know, we're not really going to be developing more land-based wind in New York. You may see some offshore wind off the coasts of Long Island. Land-based solar is certainly going to become an important part of our renewable energy mix as we work towards our CLCPA goals. And where's the flat, open, sunny land near transmission infrastructure? Farmland.
Right.
So, you know, we've got this sort of perfect cocktail that could transition, you know, potentially hundreds of thousands of acres of farmland into solar. And, you know, we're not against solar. We're not against solar development. We're not against using farmland for solar either. You know, I think that there are real synergies to support farm viability, economic viability, intergenerational transition, if it's done well and if it's done right. But we definitely want to make sure that we're doing this in a thoughtful and smart way. And we've been leading a project in New York for, gosh, the past several months this year, and we're going to be having a big release early next year of our report and our recommendations to achieve smart solar siting on farmland. So, little teaser for you all.
Yeah, well, one thing that we all know is solar does not produce local food.
That's true.
And we do not want to lose our local food either, because that is just so important. I mean, I think we saw it more during the pandemic than, or became aware of the importance of it during the pandemic more than ever, when the supply chains got messed up. You know, our local farmers were really resilient and they were able to stay in production and be there for us. So that was really important. But I remember we had a conversation a while ago, or I was listening to you talk about solar farms actually can increase the production. Is that true? Do you know anything about that? I had heard that, you know, if you are growing vegetables next to a solar farm, that whether it's because it attracts more sun or, you know, I'm not really sure why, but is that true? Does production of vegetables go up being close to a solar farm?
I haven't heard that. That's an interesting thought. I haven't heard that, but when you said solar farms don't produce food, there was a little bell in the back of my mind that was like, well, you know, they potentially could. So one way that we're looking at easing this conflict, and you'll see this in our report next year on smart solar siting, is through dual use. And that would be producing energy for, you know, powering or turning on our lights or powering our refrigerators, and food on the same parcel. Now, this is a more of a cutting edge idea. There are certain farming types that are more compatible with like the current way that we're developing solar with really densely packed panels. One example comes to mind is sheep grazing. I'm sure if folks are interested in this topic or have read or learned about dual use, they'll be familiar with sheep grazing and the American Solar Grazing Association that's trying to increase the number of farmers and sheep that are grazing around panels. And there are some real synergies there. So you've got sheep that are providing vegetative management so that the grasses or whatever the developer has planted don't block the sunlight that's getting to the solar panels. And then at the same time, you're using that land in a totally different way and sort of doubling the energy output, quote unquote. So you've got the energy to power your home and also the energy to eat, you know, through your lamb meatballs or your lamb burgers or what have you. And then you're also, you know, reducing the mowing that's happening. And those are usually gas powered machines. So that's a really nice synergy when developers are, you know, taking the farmers' considerations into mind, making sure that they've got fencing and access to water and the kinds of things that the farmer needs for their flock. The more cutting edge ideas come in with crop production around panels. Now, this is going to require probably a different design of your solar facility, more spaced out because you need more sunlight to penetrate to the ground. It's not just the solar panels taking all the sun. they would need to share it with the crops underneath. But for shade tolerant crops, there are some studies that are going on, and there's this is called agrivoltaics. It's a newer idea in the US. It's not as new in other countries like Japan and Germany or France. But this is one of those things where, particularly on Long Island, where you've got really good farmland and obviously a lot of sun resources. People love to go there in the summer for a reason. And you've got a pretty thriving local food system and high land values. If you're going to be using any of that farmland for solar development, you really want to make sure that it's in dual use or agrivoltaics. And we certainly see, particularly on Long Island, an opportunity for this, but it takes incentives, pricing incentives for developers because it's a little more expensive. Like I said, they have to space them out so they're not generating as much energy as with a traditional array. They may have to vault the panels, raise them higher off the ground so that farm equipment can get underneath. So it's a completely different design. Very innovative, requires some supportive policies and some real innovative thinkers and leaders to start establishing this. We have some of those developers in the Northeast and throughout the United States, but hopefully we'll see more of that in the future and we'll see some proof of concept there since it's so new.
Uh-huh. Takes biodiversity on the farms to a whole different level.
Yeah, right. Yeah, like, is solar a crop? I don't know.
Right. Not really, but dual use. What? Going back to New York State, what's New York State's climate action plan? And are we on target for the Climate Leadership Community Protection Act?
That's a good question. There are a lot of things that are happening in New York around climate. A few come to mind, so I'll start with the Climate Action Plan. So last year, many of us, myself included, were meeting as part of these advisory panels to look at what are our goals, what emissions reduction are we trying to achieve. In the case of the Agriculture and Forestry Advisory Panel, how are we sequestering more carbon? Because we know we need to do that. We've got to take the carbon that's already been released into the atmosphere and put it back into the ground and into vegetation. So we were all working last year, us and all the other panels and working groups were working last year to develop some recommendations. Those have now been going through for the last 6 months or so, an interagency review and like a harmonizing, bringing everything together. There is now a draft scoping plan, and the scoping plan is the pathway. How are we going to get to the goals that we've set for ourselves for emissions reduction? 85% reduction in emissions by 2050, and net economy-wide net zero emissions by that same time. So there are all kinds of pathways that are going to be detailed in that document. That's going to be made public sometime early next year. So folks can look out for that if you want to read a 300 to 400 page document about how New York is going to achieve its climate goals. But there is going to be a robust public comment process. So if folks have the time, the expertise, and the inclination, certainly organizations like ours will be involved in that review and making recommendations.
We need the cliff notes.
Yeah,
we
right.
We need the cliff notes.
Yeah, I think a lot of us are going to need the cliff notes. But the uh-huh. agriculture sections are a little shorter, the agriculture and land use sections. So if you have less time and, I'll be honest, I've seen a draft version of it, because it was sort of slyly made public by Politico. And it took me an hour to look through the agriculture sections of that. So there's that's coming out. Certainly folks can pay attention to that, get involved in that hearing process, providing comment on that. There was also a bill that was passed as sort of a tandem effort this past year. Assemblywoman Donna Lupardo, who represents the Binghamton area and Broome County, and Senator Michelle Hinchey, who's a newer senator from the Hudson Valley. They're both of our ag chairs in the Senate and the Assembly in New York State. They passed the Soil Health and Climate Resiliency Act with flying colors, absolute unanimous consent passing this bill in the last legislative session. And we're hoping that Governor Kathy Hochul will sign that bill before the turn of the year. So we're hoping we'll have something to celebrate. And that's a bill that's going to lay a foundation, you know, really a groundwork, if you will, pun intended, a definition for soil health in New York, some aspirational standards that farmers can look to meet, and, you know, some other initiatives at the Department of Agriculture and Markets to really bring soil health to the fore. And as we know, soil health also contributes to carbon sequestration and climate resiliency. So this is an important climate bill that we're looking at. And then I can pause there. I've got a couple of other ideas, but I don't know if you wanted to ask a different question. Well,
I want a question about the Soil Health Resiliency
Act. Yeah, great.
What does that have in it to prevent farmers from using pesticides and herbicides into the soil? Does it have that?
It doesn't address pesticide and herbicide use. It's a bill that is a foundation. It's a first step. You know, obviously I say first step knowing that farmers and the Department of Agriculture and Markets and Cornell and AFT and many, many other organizations have been working for decades and longer to steward our land in ways that are sustainable and environmentally sustainable. But this bill is really a way to set a definition for soil health in law. So now if Governor Hochul signs this bill, we would have a definition for soil health the same way that we have, you know, the Clean Water Act at the national level. So this is pretty groundbreaking, even though, you know, it's really just setting a legal definition and creating a few initiatives. But I think that kind of like the CLCPA, the work of how this will be implemented is going to take place after it hopefully gets signed by the Soil and Water Conservation Committee, and sort of what the standards look like. All of that is going to be unfolding over the course of, you know, the months and years to come.
Yeah, because
so
I know
directly address,
here on Long Island, I'm sorry, right. Here on Long Island, there was, you know, they were trying to pass a regulation to prevent the nitrogen fertilizers, and, you know, that was turned down, you know, so there's really, you know, they have not reined those restrictions in yet. And if people keep putting the pesticides and herbicides down, especially here on Long Island, where we get our water from our aquifers, you know, it's just a bad, really bad situation. So,
yeah,
you know,
so one,
we need
one
something that's going to address this.
Right. One thing that's in the bill, you know, certainly part of soil health is nutrient management. So making sure that farmers are applying nutrients or fertilizers at the right rate, in the right place, at the right time, all of that is going to increase the amount of those fertilizers that your crops are using, you know, as their food source, and decrease the amount that's running off. So there is a tension to that. It's not a ban, but it is aspirational. Many farmers have been adopting those kinds of practices for a long time with the help of experts and other folks who have been studying this. You know, of course, farmers need to be able to add nutrients so they can grow their crops. But it does need to be done in a way that reduces runoff from the fields.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Particularly for an area like Long Island, where your water comes from aquifers, and, you know, water is life, as they say, and it's absolutely true.
Yeah. And like what you shared with us at the beginning, how the lack of water out west is really debilitating farmers and making it so difficult. Mm-hmm. And yet we still allow companies like Nestle to take the water for free and bottle it and sell it back to us. I mean, we have so many conflicts of interest in our
policies. A world we live in.
right. You know, it's like I still can't figure out how they get away with that. So I wanted to ask you if you could shed some light on what's going on with our organic dairy farmers. I know here in New York, the international company Danon, canceled the contracts with our dairy farmers, who were Danon actually owns Horizon Milk. And so they canceled, I think it was 89 Northeast farmers from their contracts. And, these dairy farmers now have to find new places to new markets for their milk. Can you talk a little bit about, the reality of organic factory farms versus regular people really doing organic farms and the challenges and, just to shed a little light on that for some of my listeners?
Unfortunately, I can't. I'm not really the expert on this. What I can say is I really feel for those dairy farmers. It's hard enough to make it work. It's hard enough, with the low prices, the high input costs, and getting squeezed out. I know that this has been a very stressful time for those farmers. I know that there are folks who are paying attention, politicians who are paying attention, who are trying to do something about it. I was just trying to look. I think that there was a company who, I can't remember who it was now. Somebody out there is going to be screaming their own name, but there was a company that sort of rushed in and said, we'll pick up some of the contracts. I think that probably the dairy industry, these are deeper, bigger issues that we're looking at that go back to the pricing that's set and how that's done. And I am certainly not the expert in that. It takes a lifetime, okay, I think, for a person to understand the dairy industry.
Well, I'll bring you back to what I know you are an expert in, and we can talk about farm to school programs, because I know that's much more your area. I just, as a board member for NOFA, I just know, it's just such an issue for the New York organic farmers. But with the farm to school program, I recently got a call from one of my local farmers saying that there was a new initiative that I actually hadn't heard about, where there was an initiative for farmers to give food to schools. And I guess they were going to be subsidized, something like that. And I hadn't heard about that. Can you talk about that? Do you know what that farmer was talking about for me?
Might you be talking about Nourish New York?
It could be. He wanted to grow food for schools because there was an incentive for him if he did that.
Oh, okay. Right. So this is the farm to school program. Nourish New York is a little different. In fact, when you were describing what you were doing to bring food to people who need it, I was just thinking to myself, it's like your own little personal Nourish New York program. That's a program that was started during the pandemic when farmers were dumping milk or, leaving crops out in the field because they couldn't get them to market. And the state stepped in to buy them and bring them to food banks or other places in need.
Yeah, I know about that.
Right. So that's a little bit different than what I think you're describing, which is the Farm to School Incentive Program, the very one that I and my team and so many others, you included, worked to get passed back in 2018, 2017, really is when it started, and even earlier than that. So this is the program that for schools that spend 30% of currently it's their lunch budget on New York grown foods, they get quadruple their per meal reimbursement from the state. So it's a nice little incentive, a financial one for schools to increase the amount that they're spending on local food. And knowing that sometimes local food, not always, but sometimes local food can be more expensive, this is an important way to bridge that gap. And then also to cover some of those soft costs of connecting with the farmer who called you outside of the sort of well-established supply chains.
Well, I knew of the 30% 30% initiative for the schools, and I fought, I really tried to work on getting milk on Long Island be acceptable to that, because prior to this past September, we could not get we could not get milk that qualified for that incentive, but now we can.
Which is groundbreaking
incentive. It was really great. But I had not heard of the incentive directly to the farmers, because I had had made some contracts with farmers to grow butternut squash, for instance, for our school. And they grew an extra 900 pounds of butternut squash for the school district that I could buy. But they did not get in. There was no incentive to them to cut our costs for it. I mean, we, you know, we paid them a fair price, but it was a, you know, certainly more than what we normally spend on a vegetable, because it was coming from a local organic farmer. And I did not know of a subsidy that would help pay for that, those vegetables to the farmer. And this farmer that called me was talking about an incentive that where they would get money back for growing the food. Did you know of that?
Yeah, I don't know of one. It may have just been a misunderstanding. Certainly we know that there are barriers that farmers face in selling to schools. And that's something that I know the team in New York is going to be hopefully focused on in the coming years. But I don't know of any such policy unless it's something local. One thing that did happen, and you may be sort of clued into this, is last year the state started supporting a regional farm to school coordinator program. So it's not a direct incentive to the farmer, but it is a sort of team or army of people across New York that are equipped to help make those connections and reduce those soft costs of connecting a school to a local farmer.
Yeah, because
I wish something like that existed, what you're describing. I think that farmers could really use it.
He seems to think there is, so I'm going to go back to him and find out, because one of the challenges I had as the farm to school coordinator was our grant covered my salary, not very much, but it covered my salary, and it covered some infrastructure for the school to help make the cafeteria be able to handle cooking from scratch a little bit better. But it did not cover, and it covered some educational workshops, but it did not cover the cost of food. And as you know, the cost of fresh vegetables is much more than the frozen stuff that they get, you know, especially if they're getting it as part of their subsidies, you know.
Right.
So that was our biggest challenge, you know, when we were paying $1.90, I think it was a pound for the butternut squash times 900 pounds. Butternut squash, me to just give out samples to the kids. So that was our biggest challenge, was there was no money in the grant for the vegetables.
Yeah, I think the idea behind the incentive is that you get a little price support if you hit that 30% mark. I know that in those grants, they don't cover the cost of purchasing food. But the idea is that the incentive does that, but it's only if you hit that 30%.
Right. So I don't know if they're doing that. You know, my position was suspended during COVID. And so they just recently called me back. And unfortunately, I'm now working full time in our family business, and I couldn't leave because we had lost so many workers during COVID. So, so my farm to school position right now is, you know, permanently on hold. Hopefully they're finding someone else. I'd love to go back to it sometime because it's certainly more of my passion. But it's, I haven't seen the reality of getting the milk in there and whether our school has been able to get up to the 30% or not. But I know I was really working for that because it's so important.
Oh, man.
I know.
Totally.
I know.
Oh, too bad. Too bad that you're not able to be there at this time.
Yeah.
I do hope that they're getting somebody in. I hope so.
Yeah, I
and in fact,
too.
Yeah, I'll give a plug for some work that Michaela Ruiz Ramon, who's on the New York team, our policy associate or policy coordinator in New York. She is leading our farm to school work in New York now, and she's been doing a fantastic job of coming up with an idea for how to like keep growing the program. You know, because like I said, right now it's focused on lunch. That's been a big barrier for schools, we've heard, is just having to separate out lunch from other meals. Obviously for Long Island, not having access to New York dairy, New York milk, was a big barrier. So we're trying to come up with ideas, and we're advocating for that for next year's state budget, hoping that Governor Hochul will really take this on and fix this program, frankly, because I think that it is going to face some growing pains if some changes aren't made.
Mm-hmm. Another thing that came across my my feed this past fall was a petition to allow whole milk back into schools. Have you heard about mm-hmm. That push? I mean, I think right now, you know, there was such a push to get low-fat milk, you know, but at the same time, there's studies out there that says whole milk is better for kids than low-fat milk.
I haven't
position on that.
Not being a nutrition expert, I can't say, but I can't imagine that is a new initiative. I think that probably that started back when, you know, we were talking about reducing fat and sodium in schools and continues to this day.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, Samantha, I can't believe it. We're just about out of time.
Man, time flies.
It does. It does. Just before we sign off, I just want to know, with your new position, how is it going? I mean, last time I spoke to you, you were just making that transition, and I just want to know how you're doing with it.
Yeah, thanks for asking. It's nearly 3 months now, so still very new. You know, for anybody who's gone through a job transition before, you'll recognize it takes a while to get your feet under you. You know, there's a lot to learn. It's exciting, a lot of exciting things to learn. It's an exciting new challenge to be working in a different sort of arena rather than Albany, you know, being focused on DC, and your sort of worldview expands from the boundaries of New York to the boundaries of the United States. so there's a lot
big
to
difference.
Learn. Big difference. But, you know, the work is it's the same. It's how can we support farmers in, you know, making sure that they can stay in business and keep their land in farming and farm in ways that are sustainable. At its heart, it's the same work. It's just a different pathway to get there. And figuring out those pathways is always the most fun part of the work that I do. And, you know, the calls to action there, we still have calls to action. We've got the active reconciliation call to action. So now is the moment to call particularly Democratic U.S. senators. Call your Democratic U.S. senators and let them know you want this $28 billion for conservation, agricultural conservation programs, and reconciliation. And there are plenty of other ways to get involved. Like I said,
Samantha,
the scoping plan next year.
Do me a favor. Send me that link and I'll share it out in my newsletter. Okay. And we're out of time. So I just want to thank you so much. And I want to thank all my listeners
pleasure.
For joining us today, and stay in touch. I really love the work you're doing.
Yeah. Thank you. Likewise. Thanks for
You're welcome. Everyone out there, have a great rest of the week, and I'll see you all again next week. Bye for now.